Guys, so welcome to You've Got Time podcast's first supplemental bonus episode. This is going to be the first of hopefully many bonus episodes in the podcast focusing on specific issues within the fourth season of Orange is the New Black. So I was really interested in watching the fourth season about Sophia and the horrors she faced in solitary confinement, ostensibly for her own protection. And so I sort of looked some stuff up, I researched it, and I came upon solitarywatch.com, which is a site online that kind of wants to bring the horrors of solitary confinement to light to the general public. It's one of the only places you can go online to get news and things about solitary confinement, the practices that are going on, as well as reform and all sorts of different things, all the information that you could possibly want. So I reached out to the website, and Jean Casella, the co-director, graciously agreed to an interview with the podcast. And so that's what this episode is all about. So it's just me and Jean talking about solitary confinement. I kind of give her a couple questions about, what's going on and the history of solitary watch and, just about solitary confinement in general. So consider this like solitary confinement 101. So you can kind of become a little bit informed about the issues and, make your own decisions, maybe act on some of the things that you learned in the episode. So, in addition to the website, solitarywatch.com, they also have a book out, which we will link to on the website, as well as the piece that goes up on hiddenremote.com, and you'll hear us talk a little bit about that within the episode as well. So we hope that you learn a little bit more about this issue and think a little bit about deeper about it and just issues in our criminal justice system in general. So as always, please feel free to send us comments, concerns, questions. If you want to say hi, just reach out on Twitter at You've Got Time Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ You've Got Time Podcast, and via email at You've Got Time Podcast at gmail.com. Thanks so much, guys. Hope you enjoy the talk. Just to kind of start off, for those who might not be familiar with the site Solitary Watch, can you just talk a little bit about the mission statement of the site and let us know what the site's all about?
Yes, yeah, Solitary Watch was founded in 2009. And at that time, there was really no information out there about solitary confinement in U.S. prisons and jails. We called it the biggest domestic human rights crisis that no one had ever heard of. There are about 80 to 100,000 people on any given day in America in solitary confinement. And we thought this was something that should be brought to the attention of the public. Our background is in journalism. And so we just started to investigate and write about solitary. And we depend a great deal on the words of people themselves who are in solitary confinement.
Right.
So we publish articles, we publish firsthand accounts, we publish investigations, resources, all kinds of information about solitary confinement. And the site is solitarywatch.com.
Yeah, and it's a really great, I've been kind of following ever since I started to learn more about a couple of the issues on Orange is the New Black. I've been following your site, and every week you put up 7 Days in Solitary, which is a really great little piece that kind of, collects all of the articles from the week in Solitary and puts them in a very convenient form. So you can just go there and check out what's been happening.
Right. There's actually been an increase in attention to solitary confinement just in the past couple of years. A lot of activist groups like the ACLU have gotten very involved in the issue, and it's sort of a grassroots movement against it. There's been a little bit of legislation placing for the first time limits on the use of solitary,
mm-hmm.
but we still have a long, long way to go.
Right. And so the ACLU, was that due to, you know, one of the things that, you know, obviously on Orange is the New Black, Sophia Brissett, she's a minority and she's also transgender. And are those populations more likely to be placed in solitary confinement?
They are. Both people of color and LGBTQ, and particularly transgender people, are more likely to end up in solitary. The number of African-American people in solitary is even more disproportionate than the amount number of African-American people in prison in general.
Mm-hmm.
Often that's because prisons are in rural areas and most of the guards are white. Many of the prisoners are people of color, and there's real conflict there. In terms of transgender, often, you know, transgender women are actually placed in male prisons,
right?
You know, depending on what their legal gender status is.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually did an investigation a couple of years ago about what happens to transgender women in male prisons in New York State. And virtually all of them had been in long-term solitary.
Right.
They're placed there supposedly for their own protection. It's called protective custody, but it's exactly the same conditions as people who are placed there for punishment. And also we found that a large percentage of the transgender women had actually been abused by prison staff,
right,
had been sexually assaulted or otherwise abused by prison staff while they were in solitary. So this really, you know, it's really a terrible situation.
Right. And it's not necessarily a way to make anyone more sensitive to the issue. It's just a way of ignoring it.
Well, it's a way of sort of, yeah, pushing it, hiding it away. I mean, solitary by nature is a kind of hidden practice. You know, most people in solitary can't have visitors. They can't make phone calls. They're not allowed to be interviewed by the press. So it really is a hidden world. And I think it's a very positive thing that that world is being revealed on television, even to a small extent.
Right. And, you know, like I said, Sophia Brissett is such a beloved character on the show. And then we see her in the situation she's in, this season. And, you know, she's trying, I think maybe you said you hadn't seen the episodes, but she's really trying to get some sort of communication with the outside world. So she floods her cell and then she lights her mattress on fire. At one point we see her blood all over her cell. So she's very, you know, she's trying to get, you know, some sort of contact with the outside world, and the prison's not really listening to her. So she's getting more and more desperate. And, you know, as she's a character that people love, you can really kind of sympathize. I mean, you know, obviously it's not the same as experiencing the hell that is solitary confinement, but, you know, some people can kind of see that and maybe start to think about the real life implications of those practices.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. And all of those incidents that you've described are, you know, straight out of real life. People trying to set things in their cell on fire, or flooding their cells, or cutting themselves is really, really common in solitary. Also, even among like adult men, which is a population that isn't really into cutting in general. People are just so desperate for human contact. I think if, you know, really stop to think about what life would be like without any human contact whatsoever, you know, 23 to 24 hours a day alone in a small cell. Usually the cell has a solid steel door rather than bars, so you can't even see the person across the way from you.
Right.
Any contact you have with the outside world happens through a little food slot. You know, it's just an extreme form of isolation.
Right. And I know you had mentioned, in our previous conversation that you, that, you know, even if people are seeing, you know, practitioners for health or mental health, they're being treated quite often through that little slot in the door. They're not being treated in the same room as a practitioner.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard a story from one guy who is diabetic, and in order to get his insulin injections, each day he needed to extend his arms through the feeding slot and get an injection that way. I mean, someone wouldn't open the door and come in and treat him.
Right.
And yes, psychological counseling is often like shouting through that feeding slot.
Which is kind of ironic because it seems like solitary confinement causes a lot of mental health problems as well. You know, being in there for more than, you know, there are some people that have been documented, you know, decades in solitary confinement, and that definitely has some sort of mental effect and, you know, reshapes your brain in some way.
It does. It has really far-reaching psychological implications, and there's new research that, yes, suggests that it has a neurological impact too, that it actually changes brain function, and after a relatively short time too. So, you know, the movement to limit solitary confinement usually suggests that the cutoff be 2 weeks, because it's thought that after that, the damage begins to become irreversible. So 15 days is a limit that's been recommended, for example, by the United Nations.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so in other countries, you know, I don't know if your research extends beyond, you know, American solitary confinement, but is it slightly different in terms of how they utilize that? Like, are there countries that do adhere to the 2 week limit, or what's kind of going on outside of our country?
Well, it's extremely different, and it's simply not done in the rest of the sort of Western industrialized world to any kind of extent that's comparable to what's done in the United States. You know, we're on a par with countries like Iran in terms of the use of long-term solitary. And we did actually travel to do some research in Britain, and I also, you know, researched what goes on in other European countries. And usually in Britain, for example, there's a 72-hour limit on placing someone in solitary. So that's 3 days. Mm-hmm. And after that, they have to get the approval of, like, the Ministry of Justice in order to extend it further. And they have to make sure that there's psychological testing and that it's not going to cause the person harm. And they have to justify it. Whereas here, people are put in solitary. I mean, I think it's really important that your listeners know that beyond people who are put in for protective custody and have done nothing wrong, people who are put there for disciplinary reasons, it could be because of, you know, disobeying a direct order, which means you don't respond quickly enough when a guard tells you to do something, or it could be because of contraband. And contraband isn't just drugs or weapons. It's also too many postage stamps, too many pencils, food, you know, taken back from the mess hall. So there are really trivial nonviolent reasons why people get sent to solitary.
Right. And then actually in previous seasons of Orange is the New Black, we've kind of seen, you know, there have been guards on the show that have even just said, been angry at a prisoner just because of a personal reason. And they're like, you're going to the SHU. And then they're like, why? And they're like, we'll figure it out later. So, you know.
Right, exactly. I mean, they can make up charges. Mm-hmm. It's a very easy thing to do. And going back to what you said about, you know, the mental health effects, I also want to emphasize that a lot of people who get sent to solitary end up there because they already have underlying mental illness. And they act out because they're not being treated properly and not getting the right medications or, you know, whatever reason. But it's thought that, like, at least a third of people in solitary in most states have an underlying, like, mental health diagnosis.
Right. And they're not getting treated because the doctors aren't going down there. And even if they are, they're not being treated in a way that, you know, I was a therapist for a long time. And, you know, you don't treat someone through a door. You know, body language is a big part of treating someone who has
mental
health
privacy
issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everyone else can hear what's going on. Of course, people don't open up in those circumstances.
Right. I can't even imagine. That would be incredibly difficult to have. I mean, and also I would also assume I recently read Shane Barrow, a reporter from Mother Jones, wrote an article about his experience in a privatized prison and how he was interacting with someone in solitary who was trying to commit suicide by jumping off of his bed. You know, that I would assume that suicide attempts skyrocket when prisoners are in the solitary population.
Yes, actually about 5% of people prisoners nationwide are in solitary, and yet 50% of all suicides take place there.
Wow.
So that's a huge, you know, disproportionate number.
Right. A lot of, you know, a lot of time. And it's, you know, especially if you're already having those thoughts, then there's no one around to interact with you and kind of distract you from those thoughts, which is really a you know, horrifying thought.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, there have been some developments recently with the Rikers putting restrictions on, working on putting restrictions on solitary. I know that there was supposed to be a cutoff of July 1st, I believe, but they kind of pushed it out a little bit. And that's kind of been a recent thing in the news about solitary. So is that just specifically for teenagers or is that for the entire population of Rikers?
It is for teenagers, 16 and 17-year-olds in New York who are accused of felonies automatically go into the adult system.
Mm-hmm.
And juveniles in solitary in general is a huge problem as well because juveniles are supposed to be separated from the adult population mm-hmm. when they're in prison. But that often means, especially in small, you know, local rural jails, they might be the only juvenile in the jail. Right. And that means they're in solitary confinement mm-hmm. for the entire time that they're there. Rikers has made some attempts. They're also supposed to place time limits on solitary for everyone. But there's been a lot of pushback from the guards and it has been postponed several times. There are other states where there have been reforms that have been more successful.
Oh, okay.
Colorado, for example, has reduced its population in solitary from 1,500 to 150 under the leadership of a you know particularly progressive head of the Department of Corrections there. That is, it's not as perfect as it sounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the conditions that have replaced solitary are not that much better, but it's definitely, you know, a sincere attempt to recognize the harm done by solitary and come up with alternatives. There are a few other states. Washington has reduced its population. And then there are states that have done so under pressure from lawsuits like California, which was a really terrible practitioner of solitary confinement. It had hundreds of people who had been in solitary for more than 10 or 20 even years.
Right.
And a lawsuit is forcing them to reassess all those people and move many of them out of solitary.
Wow. And that's, yeah, that, I mean, 10 or 20 years, I can't even imagine that's a, you know, that's half a life or a large chunk of a life that you're in, you know, solitary confinement.
And change there, in addition to the lawsuit, was also spurred by a hunger strike among the people in solitary, which went on for several months.
Right. And I know there's, there was also a recent article on one of your recent 7 days in solitary, pieces online about a hunger strike that in, I think it was Wisconsin or somewhere where someone was being force fed.
One in Wisconsin.
Right. And
yeah, it's really terrible because this is, you know, people who go on hunger strike do it because it's like they're at an absolute desperation. Mm-hmm. And it's the only power that they have left. And when you force feed people, you're taking away, you know, even their sense of agency and in order to, you know, to be able to do something that desperate.
Right.
You know, you're taking that last recourse away from them. So I think there are two or three people who are still being force fed in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that actually, I believe on the second season of Orange is the New Black, one of the inmates, she's a nun, actually, and she went on a hunger strike with a couple other inmates and she actually was the longest holdout and they ended up force feeding her. And it was a really sort of tragic moment on the show because she's like, I'm refusing you, like, don't feed me. And they started feeding her. And, you know, it's hard when, you know, there's a whole structure above you that, like you said, there's no agency and you feel like you have this one thing and then they take that away as well.
Right, exactly.
And so, yeah, so that's, well, hopefully, you know, at least it's bringing, in some places, it's bringing light to the situation because people are protesting, you know, the way that they know how. So what would you say, you know, I know that there are definitely limited rights for people who are incarcerated, but what would you say that the basic rights of a person in solitary, you know, what they should be or what they are or maybe not being honored?
Well, I mean, people in prison are supposedly still entitled to a measure of due process. So when their, additional freedom is taken away by placing them in solitary, they're supposed to have a hearing. But in fact, it's really just pro forma kind of sham process in most jurisdictions, where the guard's word is always taken as the truth. Person in prison is always assumed to be lying, and something like 98% of all accusations end up in shoe time. And beyond that, while you're waiting for the hearing, you're in the shoe already. So you people always end up doing solitary time on basically on the whim of prison staff, of the rank and file guards. And there's really nothing to stop it. And I'm sorry to say that people in solitary have very few rights. If the system can really be shown to be abusive, then they might get out. But there's not nearly enough legal representation to go around. So there are very few organizations that do legal services for people who are actually in prison, like the focus is on trying to keep people out of prison. So, prisoners are really like the most dehumanized and probably the most oppressed people in our
Right,
society.
and we're supposed to be, ostensibly, we're supposed to be rehabilitating them and helping them get back out to society and live productive lives. And it's really, solitary is definitely just one piece of that puzzle, but there's, that's definitely in a big way. How do you leave someone in solitary for 10 years and then, release them into the world and expect them to have any sort of, ability to get a job or even interact with people at
Right.
all? So.
No, that's a really important point. I mean, this is all part of like this punishment paradigm that is, you asked about other countries. It's not the same in other countries. I mean, there is like a genuine effort at rehabilitation in most European prisons, and we have nothing like that here. I mean, a scattered number of education programs, which are always have long waiting lists and are only available to a few people. They're never available to people who are in solitary. So that's that it is part of a much larger problem. And even beyond that, a much larger problem that there are way, way too many people in prison in this country. We have 2.2 million people. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world.
And that's, probably one of the reasons that, excuse me, that solitary is being utilized more and more frequently because, these guards are over, the system's overtaxed, and then, the guards or the prison doesn't really know what to do with the, the inmates that are maybe less than, unruly or, things like that.
Right.
So they don't really know what to do. So they just throw them in solitary and kind of put, a band-aid on a bullet wound, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
So, and kind of to circle back to talk a little bit about the rights of the people that are in solitary, I know, just from working with different populations, a lot of times, people who have the comfort to, watch a Netflix show or, to, binge on your couch all day, don't necessarily have the frame of reference. A lot of people who are incarcerated or in solitary don't necessarily have any sort of support network outside of the prison. So they, so when they do go to get, support or get some sort of, I don't know, any sort of people on the outside to understand their situation, or advocate for them, they don't really have that. So it's tough for most of them to contact the outside world and ask for help.
Yeah, I mean, we actually get dozens of letters a week at Solitary Watch from people who are in solitary confinement. Some of them just want to get, we have a free newsletter for people in prison. Some people just want to get our newsletter. A lot of people just want to reach out and make some kind of human contact. Other people are out begging for legal help, which we often can't help them with because there are just no resources in their state. We try to connect them with people, but we're not lawyers and we can't help them ourselves. But that sort of desperation to even be writing to strangers, to just to seek some kind of contact with the outside world. People in solitary say that, you know, they lose their own sense of identity and they feel, you know, unreal or invisible, or, you know, like their very existence is questioned by the total lack of contact and feedback from other human beings.
Right. Well, there's no context. It's just you in a cell. So you're alone with your brain, and there's only so long before you start to cycle back on all those thoughts, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I know, you know, you had said, you know, you receive letters. I know I'm not sure if you're aware, there's a program an agency, I'm not exactly sure, but called Black and Pink, and they have a kind of a pen pal program for LGBT people who are in solitary confinement, where you can write to them and, you know, kind of like a pen pal to, you know, talk to someone who's in solitary and give them a little bit of reprieve from, you know, not really having any contact. So are there any other programs like that out there, or anything that you would recommend?
Yeah, Black and Pink is absolutely a terrific organization and doing stuff that no one else is doing. Really, really, really important work. And we actually at Solitary Watch have started a program called Lifelines to Solitary, which people can look up on our website.
Okay.
And that it's actually right now it's just functioning for groups. So we have student groups and church and synagogue and mosque congregations and community groups that are writing to people in solitary. But we're going to expand it into an individual pen pal program in the next 6 months.
Oh, that's
so
great. And
so
we'll put a link to that.
People who are interested in contacting someone should check out our program.
Yeah, we'll definitely put a link to that on the site where we post the podcast, so that everyone can kind of get into that.
That would be great.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing, because, you know, in the end we're all just individuals and we're all just humans and you know, just looking for contact, and it's you know, it's nice to know, you know, that, you know, we can all reach out to one another in some way.
Yeah. If people want to learn more about what life in solitary confinement is actually like, especially long-term solitary confinement, we also have a new book that came out earlier this year, which is an anthology of writings by people in solitary, and it's called Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement.
And it's great. I picked it up and I really enjoyed it. It's definitely, you know, it's a tough read at times, but it's definitely puts it into context and gives a voice to people who are quite often voiceless.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that comes through is how people struggle, you know, and manage somehow, even in those circumstances, to maintain their humanity, to even maintain their sense of humor, you know, their ability to, you know, analyze and respond to their world has become so small, and yet, you know, they're able to express so much. It's really amazing.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, I can't recommend that book enough. It's, you know, it's not super long, but it's got everything that you could possibly need. It packs quite the emotional punch and informative as well too. Well, so I'm out of questions, but I do, you know, I know, you know, we'll definitely link to your site and, you know, definitely encourage people to get involved in any way they can. Are there any other ways besides, you know, the pen pal program or anything like that, that you would recommend people seek out if they're interested in sort of learning more or acting, on the, you know, solitary confinement issue?
Yeah, I would just encourage them to look also on the resources section of the site, not only to educate themselves about solitary, but also we have a list of organizations that are working to end solitary confinement. And so, for example, in addition to the ACLU, which operates in all 50 states, there's a group called the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. So, you know, people who belong to a faith community could get involved through their, you know, through that. And there are also local organizations in some states. Here in New York, there's a very active grassroots campaign And the same in California and a few other places as well. So they can find those resources on the site if they want to get involved.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you so much, Jean. Jean's from solitarywatch.com, and we'll have all those links on the site. And hopefully everyone learned a little bit about solitary today.
Thanks so much,
Thanks.
Erin.
Have a great day. Bye.